You're listening to the Flasco Oncopod, brought to you by the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology, the voice of oncology in Florida.
Hi, my name's Andrew Kirkendall. I'm from Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. I'm a clinical researcher who really spends most of my time clinically and from a research aspect, focusing on patients that have polycythemia vera. I also see other myeloproliferative neoplasms, including myelofibrosis and essential thrombocythemia. And these are kind of grouped together, classically considered myeloproliferative neoplasms, which to give some background, myeloproliferative neoplasms, or as we call them, MPNs, are really a form of a chronic leukemia. And it's important to make this distinction of chronic leukemias versus acute leukemias, because I think there's certainly a connotation that comes with talking about leukemia in general. And acute leukemias are, by and large, highly aggressive diseases whereby the bone marrow is not making functional blood cells. So these are not effective blood cells. And oftentimes, we think of acute leukemia, we think of a more aggressive disease course, certainly intensive treatments, and in some cases, poor outcomes. On the flip side, we have chronic leukemias, which are much more common. And with chronic leukemias, your bone marrow is actually producing functional blood cells. They just usually are producing too many of them. And also, these blood cells work, but we really run into issues when kind of the disease process of making too many blood cells puts you at risk for other factors, or just having too many of these kind of crowds out the ability to make other normal blood cells, or we run into other issues. And so, when we think about myeloproliferative neoplasms, that's what I think we want to come back to, is diseases where you're kind of overproducing functional blood cells, but then we need to think about how best to manage that and what risk that puts patients at. And so within the realm of polycythemia vera, this is a disease that is hallmarked by a genetic mutation that's acquired during your life. It's not something you're born with. And this mutation involves a gene called JAK2, or a protein called JAK2. The classic one is what we call a JAK2 V617F mutation. And this leads to basically the gas pedal being turned on, right? Or the gas pedal, the foot being kind of cemented on the gas pedal, where your body then starts to just make way too many blood cells. And these are red blood cells, white blood cells, as well as platelets. And so JAK2 is a protein that's involved in kind of multiple different types of blood cells being made. And when this mutation happens, kind of goes into hyperdrive. And instead of making blood cells when you need to, you're making them all the time. And so oftentimes patients with polycythemia vera will present with abnormal lab work. They may go and get blood work done with their normal practitioner or for some other reason. And someone may say, hey, look, you've got some abnormal blood work here. You really should see a hematologist. And they may see evidence of high red blood cells, high white blood cells, high platelets, maybe just one or two of those. Polycythemia vera is really hallmarked by high red blood cells, but it's really a disease that's causing an upregulation of all blood cells. So when someone presents to a hematologist, the hematologist will often send off a variety of testing, including repeating blood work. Typically nowadays, we can find that JAK2 mutation from sending off a peripheral blood sample. So it's not something that requires going in and basically doing a bone marrow biopsy. So we often can find that the JAK2 mutation is present from the peripheral blood. Then in the vast majority of cases, we'll recommend doing a bone marrow biopsy because that's ultimately the factory for making blood cells. And that's where we want to kind of see what it looks like in there. And typically patients who have polycythemia vera will have a bone marrow that looks like just a factory that's full, right? So just overproduction of blood cells, all types of blood cells, just really what we call a hypercellular bone marrow with quote unquote panmyelosis. This panmyelosis means just all types of blood cells are being overproduced. And that bone marrow biopsy combined with the abnormal blood counts combined with the JAK2 mutation really allow us to give a very secure diagnosis of polycythemia vera. So then the question comes, all right, well, what do we make of this diagnosis? What do we need to do? And what does this mean for me, right? So for patients with polycythemia vera, I think the first thing is most patients live a very long and fulfilling life with this disease. This is not something that really limits life expectancy to a very significant degree. And oftentimes we state that our goal of therapy is to have a long and normal life with this disease. And so oftentimes what we're doing is we're focusing kind of, and I'll talk about kind of a hierarchy of priorities when it comes to treating polycythemia vera. And I would say the number one thing that I'm focused on when I see patients with polycythemia vera is preventing things that could hurt or kill you, right? I think that this is a disease that we hope people live with for a long time. However, it comes with an increased risk of cardiovascular and thrombotic events. So heart attacks, strokes, blood clots, things like that. And while these occur quite rarely, somewhere between 1% and 5% per year in patients, obviously if you're one of those people that gets one of these things, it could be devastating, right? If you're someone who experiences a heart attack or a stroke or some sort of massive blood clot, that could certainly limit your length of life as well as quality of life. And so I'd like to do everything possible to prevent that from happening. Step two is I'd like to maximize your quality of life. Polycythemia vera comes with a variety of symptoms. I think the most prominent one for our patients is fatigue. Nearly 90% of patients with PV exhibit some sort of fatigue that's beyond their norm. And often it's very clear that it's different than kind of the level of fatigue they may have had prior to this diagnosis, or sometimes even for a year or two preceding the diagnosis. Other symptoms that can come with polycythemia vera are things like headaches, things like abdominal pain or fullness. Itching is a real prominent one. Itching typically that can be exacerbated by showering, actually. We call that aquagenic pruritus. You can get redness in the hands and burning in the hands or feet. So really a variety of different symptoms. And so we really focus on trying to mitigate those symptoms in whatever way we can. Obviously, as I mentioned a couple of times, we want you to live a long time with this disease. And length of life only matters if it's quality, right? So we want to focus on improving quality of life and kind of maximizing that as much as possible. The third focus, which right now I think is in third place, but may be something that moves up closer to first or second, is preventing disease progression. We know that polycythemia vera often remains in that as polycythemia vera for a long time, but there is an increased risk of this disease progressing to something called myelofibrosis. What does that mean? Well, we talked about the factory in the bone marrow being kind of very active, a lot of blood cell production going on there. And oftentimes I'd say, well, what if you had a factory that was making something in the real world, where if people were there 24/7, it was completely full and they were just making things all the time in this factory and there was never time for people to go home, clean up, right, spruce the place up. It would get very dirty, messy. There'd be stuff all over the place. It would just get very intolerable. And that's kind of what happens with the bone marrow, as we see just this fibrotic bone marrow you build up this inflammation and scar tissue that forms in the bone marrow. And over time, it can be not a great place to make blood cells. And we call that kind of post-polycythemia vera myelofibrosis. And when that happens, sometimes you can see the disease change. Maybe the blood counts aren't so high. Sometimes the blood counts actually come down. People have low blood counts. You can see new symptoms develop. Maybe blood cells start to be produced in places outside the bone marrow, like in the spleen. And the spleen or the liver can become enlarged. And so one of the goals we'd like to have is preventing progression of this disease over time. Unfortunately, we haven't really, developed amazing therapies to be able to confidently do that. Now, recently, it sounds like, we've started to get a feeling that some of the therapies that we have, namely interferon therapy, maybe to a lesser extent ruxolitinib, may be able to prevent or delay disease progression over time. And that's certainly very exciting. And I think that's gotten a lot of us in the field very motivated to be able to kind of change the natural history of this disease over time. And so while that has been kind of put on the back burner, we've certainly focused on thrombotic events and quality of life. I think the thought of preventing disease progression could certainly be something that we start to really focus on and optimize in certain patients, right? And then lastly, I'd say the last priority I have is to normalize blood counts, right? And I think this is something that patients are very focused on a lot of times. As you come in with these very high blood counts, I'd like to make them normal. But I really only want to normalize blood counts in so much as it helps me accomplish one of the top three goals. So if normalizing your blood counts makes you less likely to have a clot, are less likely to have a stroke or heart attack, absolutely, I want to do that. If normalizing blood counts makes your quality of life better, absolutely, I want to do that. If normalizing your blood counts makes you less likely to have your disease progress to something down the road, absolutely, I'd like to do that. But if normalizing a blood count does not accomplish one of those three goals, I'm not going to do it just to do it, right? And so I think that's a discussion that we get into a lot of times, because certain blood counts, we don't really have good data that suggests that making them normal puts you at any better risk down the road. And what it can do is put you at risk for increased toxicity from the therapies it would take to reduce that. So I think those are my kind of hierarchical goals. And now I'll talk a little bit about our approach to treatment specifically. Historically, what we've done is we've lumped people into kind of high risk for thrombosis versus low risk for thrombosis. High risk is this is not rocket science, but high risk patients we've defined as patients that are older than 60, or have a previous risk of thrombotic events. So you've had a prior stroke, heart attack, blood clot that's related to this disease, or you're older than 60, we consider those patients to be higher risk. Lower risk patients are under the age of 60 with no history of thrombotic events. In lower risk patients, what we try to do is minimize the risk for thrombosis with aspirin, a baby aspirin, plus doing therapeutic phlebotomies to keep the hematocrit, which is the percentage of blood made up by red blood cells, less than 45%. We do that based on prior studies that shows that keeping that blood that hematocrit less than 45%, some may say 42% in women, is able to reduce the risk for cardiovascular events by about fourfold. In high-risk patients, we recommend doing the same thing. Aspirin, phlebotomies is needed to keep the hematocrit less than 45%, but we also recommend cytoreductive therapy, which means some sort of medication that helps to reduce blood counts and control them in a certain area, and through other mechanisms, likely decreases the risk for thrombosis. Cytoreductive therapies can also be used in low-risk patients who have symptoms, who are dealing with needing a lot of phlebotomies, who may have other uncontrolled blood counts that we think put them at higher risk. So certainly low-risk patients may be on cytoreductive therapy. However, it is going to be limited to having some other reason why we think it's useful there. All right, so now what are our cytoreductive therapies? Well, we have really kind of three cytoreductive therapies that we talk about. One is kind of old faithful, hydroxyurea. This is an agent that's been used for the past probably 40 years or so. For this, hydroxyurea is cheap, affordable, it's easy, it's predictable. There's a lot of comfort with this. It's a pill. We can have a variety of dose ranges it can be used at, and it's been shown to reduce the risk of thrombosis. It can control the need for phlebotomies. It lowers white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. It doesn't really have as much upside, which I'll talk about with some of the other options that we have, and it doesn't consistently help with a lot of symptoms, although certainly in some patients it can help with symptoms. The second option I mentioned is something called interferon. We have two forms of interferon. One is called pegylated interferon. The newer one is called ROPEG interferon. Brand name is Bezremi. Interferon is a subcutaneous injection given once weekly or once every 2 weeks. Dose can be modified a little bit. And it's been used for a long time, studied in this disease since the early 90s, and it shows the ability to control blood counts, though it takes longer to work. And so I'd say like hydroxyurea is like driving a jet ski, interferon is like driving a large boat, where if you make changes in the dose or start therapy, you have to wait for a little bit to see those effects play out over time. Interferon is very similar to hydroxyurea in its ability to control counts, though it may take longer. Also is not consistently very helpful in terms of disease-related symptoms, but the upside of interferon is we've seen in patients that can tolerate it for 5 years or more, that it may be able to reduce the number of cells that have that JAK2 mutation, and that may provide a benefit as far as delaying progression of this disease. And that's where I think there's a lot of optimism with using interferon, and it's certainly our preferred agent in the frontline in younger patients. We do like to avoid interferon in patients that have a history of autoimmune disorders or severe mood disorders, as it can exacerbate these things. The last agent I'll mention is ruxolitinib. Ruxolitinib is a JAK inhibitor, so it blocks that inflammatory pathway that's upregulated by the mutation. Ruxolitinib was approved in the second line setting for polycythemia vera after failure or intolerance of hydroxyurea. And ruxolitinib is a pill taken twice daily, certainly comes with a higher price tag in many situations than hydroxyurea. So oftentimes we have to explore grants or other mechanisms to be able to obtain this affordably. But Ruxolitinib is very good for symptomatic disease. It helps with disease-related symptoms such as fevers, chills, night sweats, itching, weight loss. It also can help with patients who have an enlarged spleen, reliably reduces the need for phlebotomies and can lower hematocrit as well as white blood cells. And this is certainly an agent I reach for in patients that present with a high symptom burden because I think it's very, very helpful in that setting. Now, I will say recently we found from the MAGIC PV study, a study done largely in the UK, that ruxolitinib actually in patients who are on this for 2, 3, 4 years is similarly able to reduce the JAK2 mutant allele burden. And that seems to be associated with a potentially decreased or improved what we call event-free survival. So less thrombotic events, potentially delaying progression of the disease as well. And overall, I think ruxolitinib does seem to present the strongest data for reducing the risk of thrombosis due to its anti-inflammatory mechanisms of action. So those are really our three cytoreductive therapies. As you can see, very different agents, and there's risks and benefits with all of these. I didn't have time to go through all of the different risks and benefits, but this is certainly a discussion to have with your physician if you're thinking about these options, as it's worthwhile to know all the different pros and cons before going down any kind of treatment algorithm. But with that, hopefully I was able to review quite quickly the diagnosis, approach to treatment, as well as the different treatment options that we have for polycythemia vera. And I will mention that as we move forward, there's certainly advances being made in this disease process, a lot of research going on, many clinical trials that are actually being investigated right now, looking at ways to minimize the impact that phlebotomies have on patients, looking at if we can target this kind of chronic iron deficiency that comes with polycythemia vera and the symptoms that may have on patients, as well as looking at new and improved JAK inhibitors that may ultimately prove to be a game changer down the road for patients with polycythemia vera. So again, thank you for your attention and certainly hope this was helpful.